recording number 570305ACC. A lecture by L. Ron Hubbard from the 17th Advanced Clinical Course, entitled The Scale of Techniques, copyright by L. Ron Hubbard, 1957, with all real performance rights reserved.
And this is the 7th lecture of the 17th ACC, March the 5th, 1957. And today, we're going to talk some more about techniques. Now, the first and foremost technique that anybody knew anything about in this physical universe was a thing called communication. And communication was the solvent of all evils. You yourself found yourself confronted by a tremendous amount of mass and space, which you probably mocked up, however, you were such total cause on it that you decided you needed some backflow or something of the sort. You were very happy to find somebody to talk to about it. And this cured a thing called loneliness, only oneness, upsetness, lack of gameness. And communication was a great cure, and communication remains a great cure. If you were very, very sharp, and you knew your Scientology from beginning to end, you could make communication a total technique if you were that sharp. But if you knew things from beginning to end, and you knew exactly what to talk about to the preclear, and exactly what to as is in order to increase his havingness, and if you were sly enough, mean enough, wicked enough, and bad enough, which I think is all the things you have to do to exert control, you would undoubtedly be able to use communication as a total technique. You don't just have to know everything, however. You just have to know everything across the boards from one end to the other. You'd have to be a genius on exactly reaching and touching upon those exact buttons in the preclear's case, which could be as is without a reduction of heaviness. You understand? And so, in that way, communication could seem to be a total technique. Now, communication was a total technique once. It was a total technique once. Two-way communication. Now, everybody has the idea that it as is things, that it knocks things out, and by various associations, they have come to believe that mass can be disintegrated by communication. Actually, space can come into existence by communication, so communication really doesn't as is space, but it does as is mass. First sound the person ever heard, probably, was the sound he mocked up on the idea that there was sound, but after a while, he got certain conditions by which sound could occur, and we have those occurring today in elementary physics. They don't occur in advanced physics. That's left as a realm of the believable entirely. But in elementary physics, there are certain mechanics connected to sound. And it is the mechanics of sound, rather than the mechanics of communication, which give people the idea of disintegration of mass more than anything else. But we have the idea that occurred that things disappear under communication. That is rather apparent, that this idea is consistent from person to person. Salesmen use it in reverse, which is one of the things wrong with sales. They use communication in order to acquire mass, but in view of the fact that they are really giving away mass in order to acquire mass, it tends to balance it out, but it doesn't keep salesmen from going out the bottom. That may seem a little foggy to you right offhand, but the amount of communication in which a salesman is enforcing, the amount of enforced ARC, the amount of pitch on the ARC, his idea of acquiring himself some mass and a new home by selling you something you don't need and that sort of thing, keeps him consistently upset on the subject of communication. And he is upset on the subject of communication. You have to handle a salesman with great care. He is groomed in a certain direction, and he has found that certain responses take mass away from you, namely money. And certain responses let you accept mass. And he has these very well groomed, he's been taught these. And Dale Carnegie-ism is very much in our ranks. But he's elaborated on the subject of communication. When you're having communication with a salesman, you have to handle it as a very good auditor. And if you just start straight out considering a salesman in session, not selling you something, you have some remarkable luck, because you do have a fellow who is down below communications with therapy. All communication does for this fellow is to knock him flat. Do you understand? The more he communicates, the flatter he knocks. He's very confused on it. Got the idea? So, communication, then, from probably the top-notch bracket of aberration right on down the line, has seems to be a cure. There's somewhat of a curse, because two new things have been added. One of those is control, and one of them is having. The necessity to have, you mock up the idea of the necessity to have. Well, this is not compatible with communication. But let's suppose we use communication as a cure long enough, and this fellow was tired of this universe, and he communicated with somebody else about it enough so that it disappeared, and then he decided that it was a better universe than the one he has now. Then he would regret the universe which he has just lost. He'd get this involvement. And how did he lose it? He lost it by communication, of course. So he says then, that he has to have some arm. And the communication is the flow of havingness. And we find havingness then running as the cure for communication. But oddly enough, havingness is a cure from there on down. We go all the way south then. We're dealing with very, very potent factors. But now there is a whole group of free clears below the level of the ability to run trail. You find lots of them. They can't run trail. Things are insufficiently real to them. They let trail bite. It's quite peculiar, because they'll sit there and give you responses. But the degree that it's working is so slight as to say the trio is not working on them. You understand that? So there's something else wrong with these people. Something else wrong with these people from having this on down. And that something else is obsessive change. And they have so much obsessive change from the ability to have on down, that they cannot is anything. They not is everything. They cannot as is anything. They not is everything. Why? They obsessively change it. Alter, 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 alter. I point out to you something that's quite interesting. That change is part of control. Control, anatomy of. So where a person needs the ability to have, he goes into the realm of control. And we find that control works from there on down. Now apparently havingness does work from there on down. Apparently communication does work from there on down. But not so as to effect change all the way. You see, although a person can't run on it, his havingness is what is monitoring his health. Even though he can't run on it, even though he can't see it, take something away from him and he'll get sick. You understand that? It's still a health monitoring factor. Although he's sitting around grumpily saying, at no time would I permit canal, so to speak, with me. One day, like somebody omits, some canal omits speaking with him, and he feels bad. He sees definitely the communication has been withheld from him. The butler comes in or something of the sort and won't give him the message that's been left at the door. Man, does he get upset. Now, communication is not curative, but it's absence produces a considerable reaction. You got that? Fellow saying he doesn't want communication, but in its absence, he gets very upset because it's still working as an internal curative factor. Still keeping him going. Even though he says he hasn't got it, can't have it, doesn't want it. But it's bad, but it's destructive, you understand? They can tangle all of these things, but this does not make them true as far as this case is concerned. All right, same way with Hattie-ness. He tells you Hattie-ness is bad, the universe is bad. He doesn't want anything to do with things as they are, no good. Nobody was any good. He wasn't any good. You get the idea. He's going round and round. And therefore, he should get rid of everything, and everybody should get rid of everything, and there shouldn't be any more, and that's that. Even though he's saying all those things, Hattie-ness is still terribly effective on him, and his health is running in accordance with his Hattie-ness. So one fine day, this fellow is very ill, and one fine day somebody comes along and gives him a check for $10,000 so he can buy a farm or something like this. I suppose you could buy a gig to a farm for $10,000. But he acquires some Hattie-ness and he becomes well. So what a great mystery. Here. This fellow can't have anything, he doesn't want anything, he couldn't run trio on a bet, and yet somebody gives him the farm and he becomes well. In other words, Hattie-ness was still curative, but he couldn't run it. All right. Now this is quite amazing. This is quite amazing. This is an amazing phenomena you're looking at here, because the fellow is pretending that he doesn't want the medicine, therefore he obviously was trying to succumb, we say. Whereas by succumb, we simply mean he's trying to make succumb his body or something like that. But we still find that there are curative remedies of communication having this work. Now, medicine. Today, in the administration of drugs, it's just a 1-1 method of having this. It's just a 1.1 method of having this, and that's all there is to it. Look it up on the tone scale, you've got the medical profession. They cannot directly give anybody Hattie-ness, but they can let them have a few molecules in some overt capsule in a covert way, and they give them some Hattie-ness. In other words, they can slip it to them. And it is so amusing to watch them shift the formulas around and to have added Lillian and Park and Davis and other such chaps. I suppose those were all men at one time or another, but long gone to dust now. Those chaps monkey up some derivation of something, you see, and they put it in the capsule, and it's supposed to go in a certain direction, do a certain thing. Everybody gets beautifully persuaded on this, and it works for a long time. Sometimes these remedies will go for 2, 3, 5 years. Remedies wear out to a degree that they wear out the postulates, you see. They run into the resistance of can't have. Now, the cycle of medicine is quite interesting. Any new medicine brought out is wonderful today and becomes outmoded and useless tomorrow. First, it cures everything, and then the next thing you know, they find a few things it doesn't cure, and then they find a few cases that it doesn't help at all, and suddenly find some cases where it actively hurts. And the big campaign comes out against this particular medicine, and it ceases to be functional to a marked degree. But here you merely have a significance of Hattie-ness, and that is about all there is to any of these medicines. Now, it is true that certain biochemical reactions will take place because certain ingredients exist. Whatever will look this fact, you have various magical reactions. You take sodium, for instance, drop it in water, and you get boom, which is quite remarkable. The two Hattie-nesses, water and sodium, are to each other indigestible and create an explosion. Well, obviously, water is a can't-have of sodium. Sodium is a can't-have of water. And so, in all biochemical reactions, we get this Gaines condition continuing of one kind or another, to some degree or another. And looking at a Gaines condition, you actually explain all Hattie-ness and all varieties of Hattie-ness. Some things consider other things teammates, and some things consider other things enemies. And you do have only one drugs, which are the really only one, now being used medicinally, by the way, radiation elements being used medicinally all over the place. It's quite amusing because this has been going on for some time and they're now waking up to the fact that they kill faster than they cure. Well, you have an only one element.
plutonium. I think that one molecule of plutonium is at least critical of any other molecules of plutonium. And when they get sufficiently gathered together, they then decide to be apart with such violence that they set other things off too. The contagion of aberration runs rather rapidly into other elements. Get the idea. Now, can you get the idea of explaining elements and having this by the Gibbs condition and by teammates and allies and that sort of thing? It's quite interesting to look at this because all of these things were marked up and given the significance by Thetans. And they are postulates in suspension. It's quite interesting. Someday when you're running this, you all of a sudden see this, that the floor is made out of a series of postulates which are not is or alter is in certain ways, and that if you unalter is these and unknot is them with sufficient violence or accuracy, that you get something else or nothing at all. But the moment that you can take them apart, you can probably put them back together again, so it's, don't worry about the floor vanishing simply because you know what the floor consists of. If you're that good, it also takes an intention. Everything is not still operating on automatic. If you get so good that you can do this, you have to intend to do it. But if Thetans insisted that no other Thetan must come along to take apart the mass which he just mocked up, has caused an enormous number of postulates, of conditions, of considerations, all of which add up to the fact that you mustn't touch nest. Don't look at it the way it is. You see, don't look at it the way it is, and therefore it will be, because it's sufficiently continually all it is that it then persists. And you get persistence out of this alteration. We alter what it really is in our own minds, and then we never look at it as it is, and so it stays there. And so we get all sorts of weird notions. Like we have people saying the nest is sacred. That's funny when the prickles run into lots. It's sacred. It's each molecule is sacred. People get the idea that they're all dead bodies of one kind or another. They're things that have dragged in everything on themselves and therefore fixed. They get the idea that it's all poison. They get the idea that certain things accidentally combining with other things might cause reactions so horrible that nobody could confront them, so you better not combine anything with anything. Let's kind of keep it all separate. They obsessively keep things separate, and they do that long enough they collapse, like musing, because they're running basically on a law of reaction. In other words, there are tremendous numbers of considerations by which one must not look at things as they are. And part of having this is not looking at things as they are. But it's very easy to unbalance this. Things as they are, well, when you look at things exactly as they are, you will get nothing. I give you the experiment's perfect duplication as covered in Creation and Human Ability, a perfect duplicate. It's a duplication of something with itself in some space by its own postulate. You get this mechanism, perfect duplication, you get nothing. So there's this little alteration necessary. Now, this whole idea of time is simply an alteration, a parade of alterisnesses. And you get enough alterisnesses running automatically enough, and you have everybody going along in the same time span, which is quite amusing. What's amusing about it is that it is impossible to put this on total automatic. Time is so difficult to do that it still requires a considerable amount of contribution from everybody participating in it. Now, what you find fault with, and pretty clear, is that he's alterizing, changing, shifting, altering, more than he needs to. Now, I'll give you some idea of how this is produced. You take things away from a person so frequently and violently, consistently, and so irreparably, that he becomes very anxious about having this. Then he will cut in more alter-isness and more alteration and more change of consideration about happiness in order to keep it from being as is. In other words, by making somebody anxious about the solidity or something of things, he goes back on his old mechanism of alter it to make it persist. And the more you take away from him, the more he will alter things. You understand that? There is coordination then between control and happiness, and it is simply that an individual's anxiety about happiness, the existence of things, causes the individual to obsessively change those things more and more and more and more. So we get, coincidentally, this thing occurring. The more people lose, the more they change what they have. And that is a quite an interesting rule. The more they lose, the more they change what they have. Now let's take some fellow, I'll give you an example of this, let's take some fellow, you better wrap your wits around this thing, this is one of those things, this has been there understood, I have never articulated it before, or lined these three factors up where they belong, given them their proper importance. We have known about isness and not isness and all of isness for quite some time, but we never really got in there and slugged on a practical auditing level, and now we are. This is really very practical. This is real down to earth, you might say, not getting any doublet on ponder. All right. Now, here we get what happens to people when they become hemorrhoid. They depart too far from the isness of things as they are. So they go too far from it. So far that nothing that they have is real and they don't have it. In other words, they can alter things so obsessively that they cease to have them at all because they can't have the thing that is right there in front of them. They alter a chair into a window quicker than scat. You understand? They will go way over the line. Why? Because all the isness is that which preserves or continues nest. A little of it goes a long way. Now, the favorite is an alterisness of ownership, which is an alterisness of creatingness, same thing. We mock up a wall and say, isn't that a pretty wall, Joe, mocked up? As a matter of fact, that's quite enough to keep the wall there, because our basic agreement about it is that when you alter something, it persists. Joe mocks up a wall and you say, isn't that a beautiful wall I mocked up? Made it persistent. It's very simple. Continuance by various considerations made by things depends then upon all the isness. So when a person becomes anxious about continuance, like Tom Sawyer's cap, he administers just a little bit more medicine, just a little bit more painkiller. All he needs is another dose of this all the isness. Oh my, now it doesn't become one alteration of ownership. The ownership sails out into some incredible deity that was, when the wall was mocked up by Mog or something of the sort. Mog, the great god Mog, and Mog mocked up all the walls of the world. He is the god of walls. And if you touch a wall, now we'll just get a little bit more drastic about it. If you touch a wall, you insult Mog. You get the idea, and the life hereafter, we have to mock up so that Mog can punish you after you back out of your dead head. That's another altruismus, you see. Now let's just forget the deity of walls, and let's just make one deity for everything and make him so unattainable. Nobody can ever do anything about him. We get this as all there is, all there is, all there is, just a little bit further out. Now, we find out that doesn't work too well, so we add on to it the fact that all mess was originally poison, and only by looking at it in a certain way, with a certain squint in one eye, will it not bite you. We must come back and start alterizing all over again. Let's get rid of all these ideas about ownership and bury them and put them totally on automatic. Who created it? Let's get that all fouled up completely, moved clear across and out of the way, and start substituting new things. Now let's tell some real good lies about this stuff and just get going on it and just get it so submerged on all the isness that Nobody will ever get a happy idea and suddenly look at it and have it disappear. So let's say all molecules are basically poison. And this is proven by the fact that they interact in certain ways. And we could go ahead and prove to beings that they interacted badly, or that they exploded and they did bad things to people and so on. Let's grow a lot of vines and name them poison ivy and show people they shouldn't touch leaves by making these poison ivy then quite like other leaves, like plain ivy. Well, let's always plant poison ivy with plain ivy, and that'll keep the dogs and the little boys off of the stuff. You get the idea. Let's just mess this up some fierce. Let's just move it over one way or the other. And now let's invent a whole bunch of property laws. So that at any time anybody touches anything that isn't his, why, he has some tremendous corporeal punishment. His mess gets taken away from him. And we look at law, and we find that all law is based on headiness. But very little bit, and a very, very little bit of law is based on communication. But law exerts itself as control. Quite amusing. Now, you could actually postulate a number of ethics and morals and rightness of conduct and this sort of thing, but you're into the field of control. And it shows you how far south law has gone, because almost totally, disobedience of the law is about the only crime there is with regard to law. We don't any longer have law being adjudicated on simply an ethical level. It was an ethical thing to do. There is one court, I think, left in New Jersey, with an old Dianeticist running it. And there's a court left in England called the Court of Chancery, where things are adjudicated to a marked degree upon the ethics of the situation rather than the law. The rights are weighed rather than the written law. But the U.S. Supreme Court has gone an entirely different direction, and they are now adjudicating things on scientific bases. Whether something is scientific or not, is whether or not it is lawful or unlawful. This is quite amusing. I give you Senator Eastland's speech in the U.S. Senate concerning the anti-segregation decision. Quite amazing. Eastland points out, and several federal justices through the country up to this time have pointed out, that this is the first time that science, and I it's very funny to call psychology a science, because it's not. It's not based on known laws or isolated principles at all. It's just a bunch of observations canned up and put in the book. And the United States Supreme Court took some textbooks on psychology, which were written by people who had already been indicted before the House, I think, Un-American Activities Committee for Communist Activities, and which books, however, said that the Negro was as well off mentally as the white man, which may or may not be true, but they had no right to use this, you see. And therefore, and thereby, anti-segregation was decided upon. And there have been several motions introduced so far in the committees in the House and the Senate to this time to impeach the entirety of the Supreme Court except for the three justices who dissented, because they departed from disobeying the law and went over into scientific adjudication. In other words, the law has gotten so low it's not trying to enforce what some people have dreamed up and are calling scientific postulates. You get that? You get how far this is going now. It goes from ethics, where it started, ethics and mores, down to headiness and obey the law, and then down to just obey the law, and now down to did or are people obeying certain scientific principles, and if they are not, they are going to be punished by the United States Supreme Court. No scientific principles, is everybody is equal, and I don't ever see that this has ever been proven. Well, undoubtedly, Negroes smarter than I am, and undoubtedly, white men that are smarter than Negroes, any series of tests would demonstrate the fallacy of these quote scientific laws, but men are being put in jail and fined today for disobeying these decisions of the United States Supreme Court based upon a fallacious law. And I'm only quoting Senator Eastland and others as they have spoken on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Now, then you get an all nervousness, you see. Then we're really departing down the line. And the more people get anxious about having this, the further they depart down this line. You could go off the scale if you want to. It wouldn't do you any particular good as a Scientologist. An understanding of it shouldn't be yours. That at first, one thing makes postulate, and then he enforces it, or gets it agreed with one way or the other, and it becomes a consideration. And then this consideration floats along as a good game until somebody has this thing entering into the realm of having this or the game or something, and he decides that this is absolutely necessary, so he enforces this consideration and makes it against the law to disobey this consideration, and eventually we wind up with the elemental chart, Mendeleev's laws, elementary physics, elementary chemistry, and that is really the sequence. It's interesting that this sequence comes apart under auditing in a pre-clip. That's the only thing I'm telling you. Now, don't look dazed over this, because this is too easy. You've known this for a long time, that all things proceed from postulates. And I just happen to be telling you the involved way by which they do so. And the only thing I'm describing to you here is how all the isness plays its role in havingness. We get a persistence of havingness by all the isness. And we do that by enforcing the considerations back of it. And we just keep enforcing considerations, meaning all these more considerations, we go on and on and on, down the line. Next thing you know, we've gone so far that the altered thing, or the altering thing, let us say we altered, and then we got an altered thing, which wasn't the thing at all, but a substitute, and that substitute becomes more real than the object. People look at a chair and see a table, people look at the light, and see a chandelier. People look at a door and see a window. You got the idea. The substitute thing is the thing, and this is delusion. That is all delusion is. Those things have been altered to such a degree that nothing any longer resembles anything that was basically intended to be. Now, we intend a board to be a table, and this would be good enough to make it a chair. You see that? Just the fact that we said it was a table would make it a chair. All right, we say we're going to do an honest thing, and with many people, this then is an admission that we're going to do something dishonest. Do you understand? This is beginning. I mean, it's that fast. We don't even do it consciously. We simply say we're making an honest effort to do something. And at once, to many people who are completely submerged on the subject of happiness, we get they are dishonest crooks. Immediate result. You see it? Now, somebody can get into a basis, and you'll notice here I didn't mention the word either psychiatry or psychology. I think I was being very good. I didn't mention either of those words, so I missed a particular paragraph. And they get to a point where the statement that they're going to do good makes them immediately destroy anything they touch. In other words, we now get from the communication factor, where the fact that one person says to another person, I'm going to do good, and the other person at once says he means evil. So we get from there, we get a closure down to a point where just a statement or the thought that one is going to do good makes him do evil. You understand this? He just gets the one two right in himself, not on a communication basis, but he gets it on a time span of a repeated intention. In other words, the alteration becomes at once accomplished on the single statement of intention. And no matter what intention he states, he'll get another intention, all right? This fellow's trying to run a body. He said, I'm going down to the corner, so he walks upstairs. You see that? We get an alteration. We don't get it of one person by another, by which consideration all other people besides myself mean evil. Most people today in this world are to some degree on that kick. The fellows over there are bad. This is almost automatic today as a postulate. His intentions, just because he's somebody else, are not as good as my intentions. It's quite interesting. I would believe wars, by the way. You'll find everybody in the universe believes that he himself has good intentions and that other people have bad intentions. And if everybody believed this, then you would have a mythical second party in all cases. This second party did not exist at all, so he could never be analyzed or understood, so we would have evil afloat in the world. Do you see how that would be accomplished? You locked up a second party who doesn't just move. You read newspapers today, you are made to believe that the rest of the world is pretty well done rotten. That's everybody believing that everybody else is rotten. All right, now that's fine, but when you get a closure, when the communication ceases out of this, you get a complete closure, terminal, and then the person who reports on the other person is reporting on himself, and he says he was evil. Now we have everybody being evil. So it's not very much of a jump from A saying that B is evil to a closure of terminals whereby A wishes he were good but knows he's bad to A's bad. You got the notion there. It's a rather pathetic picture, by the way. It's a rather pathetic picture that everybody basically was good. And that doesn't matter to whom that applies. He basically is actually well-intentioned or ethically aligned. But he gets the idea that other people aren't, and therefore, to stay in agreement and live a life, he has to be careful, so forth. But if I've never succeeded in doing business by contract, I've only succeeded in doing business where I have had to touch the stuff. It's kind of a drug, you know, you get drunk on it very easily, business. And I've known guys who do it all the time and never do anything else. And they get to a point where they'll eventually do it totally by contract. Well, I've never had any successful business by contract. The only successful business I've ever engaged in as a writer or anything else or in expeditions has been by trust. I assume the other guy's all right and he means well and he'll do all right. As long as I continue to assume that and I never do anything else, I never have any trouble with it. But somebody has to come along and explain to me how he's bad and give me some proof to this effect and make my communication break down a little bit in order to have the other party go bad. But no contract I have ever signed has ever guaranteed the performance by itself. You understand that? It's much more important with whom you do business than how you do business. So this is much more important. Similarly, in life, you can control any sphere where you recognize the first postulate and you're tough enough to hang on to the first postulate no matter how much the automatic second postulate turns on of the old business. Do you understand that? If you're tough enough to maintain the first postulate and to take any consequences to your mess of maintaining this first postulate, you will always win because it is the senior dominating, monitoring postulate. The other fellow is a good guy. And he'll wear himself out trying to prove otherwise sometimes. Some people did in Dianetics. It was quite amazing. There two or three fellows that just knocked themselves out trying to prove that they were evil. Because what? And they never really succeeded in doing anything that had any great long-span effectiveness. You see that. The first postulate, life is life, livingness is livingness, is more powerful than death. See, the cycle of action is more powerful at the beginning than at the end. If you maintain livingness, you maintain life, and you go on living, and you go on acting, and you go on being, and you go on maintaining your own ability to grab beingness and go on dragging beingness and dragging livingness and so forth, come hell or high water, you're unassailable. It's only when you break down and go in for this alteration of the basic fact into a bunch of more consecutive facts that you lose your grip on the communication line and go into havingness. And there's how a person arrives into havingness. He falls for this death postulate, it's the come postulate, as an alteration of the life postulate in order to make life persist. But here's something very peculiar. It requires no effort on his part to make life persist because life is survival. It's very funny. Would you work to make a hungry child hungry? In such a wise, why work to make a total survival being survive, you see? Well, the only way you'd be able to work at this would be to fall for the second postulate and believe he's dying. Now, what does a Scientologist who calls a thing back to a body and makes him reanimated do? What does he do? He actually won't fall to the fact of death. The guy's blinded, stretched out, he's pale, cold, there's no pulse, no heartbeat, you see. No breath on the mirror. And he says, come back and take over his body. And the fellow says, oh, somebody saw me, and he comes back and lifts an eye, and here's what I want. It's quite interesting. But what has he done? Basically, he has simply not thought for any consideration for the idea of death, which is a falsity and an alteration, don't you see? You see, that is a dreamed-up fact. Life isn't dreamed up. Anything from there on is. Now, you fall to the dreamed-up fact, and then you lose your ability to handle and monitor life, and you go into happiness as the thing. So in order to go into happiness, you have to go into death. Your first consideration after you start fooling around with happiness is that something can die. Things can disappear. Well, if you walk up something and say it's not going to disappear, that should be enough. That should be plenty. There shouldn't be anything else connected with that. Now, where we have life, somebody has said, we have hope. No, I'm afraid we have more than hope. We have life. Now, how would we get into any kind of a situation whereby there was no life? Well, we have to assume it. Now, we can say, there's a markup, it will persist, and that should be that. But instead of that, we use the Vita. We say, my posture isn't good enough to make this mock-up persist. I've got to enter into some kind of a nonsensical, hurdy-gurdy scheme of things by which I say that this posture was not made by myself, it was made by God. And oh. And only that way can it persist, because things which are altered persist. We have to make this other set of postulates, things which are altered persist, which is easier for other people to follow, we feel. Well, when we pick up something that's easier for other people to follow, we've once lost any faith in anybody else to respect the fact that you mocked up something, and therefore you didn't persist, and we've already said they aren't ethical, they aren't alive, and so we went into some other system, and we're in the food. And there's where all your alterisnesses and alterations occur in hands. Now, when we notice that if happiness is made to persist by change, then perforce control is lower on the scale of operational techniques by the auditor than happiness. But remember that happiness is all the way down. Remember that communication is all the way down, too. But at this stage of the game, only control is observably all the way down. You understand, all three of these things go all the way south. But the tab that is left open for you to audit at first entrance into the case is control. The exercise of control, of course, takes away the automaticity of change. And so, to a marked degree, wipes out alteration. And so makes having this possible. It's as simple as that. Control is start, change, and stop. Alteration is change. So we run hand contact mimicry with somebody, and we are controlling his hands. Well, don't be surprised if his hands become more real to him. What do we mean by more real? Then we mean simply that he's not so obsessively altered as in hands that he cannot have hands. He now can have hands. You see that? By control, he knocked out some obsessive alteration. And had he knocked it out, we then increased his ability to have. Now, it's quite remarkable. We just conducted a little test for your benefit. So, at the HTC, just did this one thing. We took a look at me, who am I? And ran it for a couple of hours, and it didn't flatten. And obviously, on that person, it was the recent change, but on that person, it didn't even evidently have a show of flattening within a week. So I asked the auditor to get off of that now, and let's get on to SCS. object, the auditor, who had seen an object. By the way, as people get better, other people become objects to them. Quite interesting. I don't know what another person is to a nuclear physicist, but any sane person under auditing, coming up scale, gets that as one of his first considerations. He says, well, now I've been paying token grace to the idea that other people were alive and all of this. It's sort of an education level. People become objects to it. They become more solid, more real. And after SCS was run on this preclear, the auditor caught the preclear looking at him very fixedly, examining him in a rather interested way. Got the idea. In other words, look at me, who am I? Flattened by running SCS. Got that? Well, he found an auditor by running SCS. But remember, that SCS was run with a heavy control factor by agreement with the auditor, much heavier than this auditor's ever run anybody before. Crunch. You understand? On a terrific control. Moody RC, tremendous control. That greatly could not bat an eyelash without permission from the auditor. You understand? That preclear was not permitted to think, act, speak, do anything except follow the auditing command at the instant the auditing command was given. Auditor lugging the preclear into the starts, you see. All right, when I tell you to start your body, when you start your body, the auditor right there with an arm around the preclear, starting the preclear off. No other automaticity involved but the auditor. Now, it's an odd thing that on that SCS, no power of choice was allowed to preclear. Why? Because we looked at the preclear's profile, we said power of choice? And we're sure the bank has terrific power of choice. All of it, alterations. The power of choice was resident in the reactive mind of the preclear as a bunch of engrams combining with a bunch of engrams. But there was no power of choice in the part of the preclear. Some hours of this in the preclear had monitored. Heavy control, you understand? Very heavy control. But very pleasant ARC. You don't run heavy control at 1.5. Heavy control isn't any good at 1.5 because 1.5 implies a doubt that you can do it. And when you have good control, you don't have any doubts. Can you see that clearly? So the control becomes doubly vicious by running it in a high-toned way. It becomes violently horrible. You say to a person offhandedly, pleasantly, nicely, smooth, cultured voice, you say. Now when I tell you to start the body, I want you to start the body in that direction. All right, start the body. Preclear goes this way. The auditor's arm, the back of the preclear, and the auditor starts the body just as nice as you please. This becomes horrible. Think of control has broken down the moment the auditor would say, I told you to start that body. When I say start that body, I didn't start that body. It's not that body. Oh, no, that isn't an impressive level of control. That isn't impressive at all. You know what impresses people about control is effortless control. That's what impresses them about control. But when you substitute your body's arm in a friendly way, you actually are not substituting a great deal of effort. They'll go along with it to the degree that your hand is friendly. Quite amazing. I ran a rapids once in a survey vessel. I was sitting in the navigator's chair with my feet up on the railing, smoking a cigarette. I wasn't looking at the charts or anything else. I wasn't doing anything. I was just sitting there, looking at the scenery, commenting on the trees as they went by at 20 minutes. It wasn't a pose on my particular part. I happened to know that that was a very, very safe channel, although it ran very fast. Even if you went over the edge and went in to the, trying to go into the bank of the channel, kind of steering yourself aground in this narrow channel, the bank itself had enough backwash to throw you back into the current again. I had seen freight cars on barges go through that at a high run attached to a tug, 4 and 5 barges attached to a tug. Those things were smooth around like a snap the snake whip, you know? And you just can't hit the bank in that, But to sit out there casually, feeling no danger myself because I knew by experience that there was none, and have a totally green crew, had never been near that place before, you see? Boy, was that impressive to them, you know? They brought me hot coffee afterwards, and, you know, fantastic. Whitewater frog in there for about 2-3 miles. You see, the accepted method of control contains some anxiety in it, don't you see? There should have been some anxiety. You should sound like you're anxious about it all, you know. Sound like there's some chance that you wouldn't get through. It gives people the sensation that you yourself personally are pushing something through. And maybe if you're casual enough and positive enough at the same time, maybe you are. Why is it that people have accidents when they're emotionally upset? It's because their control factor's dropped. But you say to these people at a high 1.5, that's not going to control things. Well, may I be? They obviously aren't because they had accidents. So it isn't necessary for you to be nasty to control people. Just be positive. And this goes all the way south, right on down to the dead man. Control must assume there is something alive there when you're controlling people. Do you understand that? Because control, on your part, assumes the business which is being controlled. Unless you can assume what is being controlled, you won't control it. So when you're controlling a human being, you must assume the business that this person is alive, is trying, and can do it. And you assume all those things they can. That's the necromancy of it all. The dead body is assumed to be alive, and so it is. Now, because there is something there that is alive, you are not re-enlivening or rejuvenating anything, but this is the way it looks to people who don't know. So what else does it take? What else does good control take? It takes a splendid knowledge of all facets of the business being controlled. They control a large vessel. It actually doesn't so much necessitate the tremendous mechanical gimmicks around as it necessitates the idea of your awareness that there is a mass there which will obey your various proddings and demands. You see? Just that. Now, we add a rather vast knowledge of its mechanical intricacies to never forgetting at once. Never forgetting that it is just a mass, and the control is just spark change and stop. Just don't get immersed in all the significances of gimmicks. Gimmicks are just gimmicks. They do not throw aside the basic fact at all that they only spark change and stop things. And we never fail to control an object. We never fail to control a person. And we can't fail to control anything. And when we can control anything, then we're not worried about controlling everything because it's not necessary, because by that time we can have some things. And a person only gets worried about controlling things when he can't have things. A person only gets worried about communication when he no longer can receive or give control. Then he's really worried about communication. He's somewhat upset about having this, but he's terribly worried about communication. In other words, the amount of worry is progressively worse as we go from the curative levels down. The person's first relieved with communication, and then the further downscale he goes, the more and more worried he gets about the cure. until the cure becomes the evil itself. So that extends from communication, which is all the way at the top, right on down through having some control, too. And a person who can't be controlled has just got the doggondest ideas about communication. If somebody says bear to him, the bear is liable to appear and bite him. I mean, he's in a bad way. Communication is just too terrible to contemplate. If all mixed up with happiness, becomes happiness, unbecomes happiness, there's all sorts of things. You can even, for your own amusement, draw the scale. One communication first as a person proceeds down scale. Now we take happiness from the moment a person can have something, and we go on down scale from there. Happiness gets worse and worse, but we're entering into control. And the more the way he expresses his concern or worry over happiness is a very simple way. He expresses it with anxiety about control. His control factor gets worse and worse until the control scale itself goes into apathy, and everything controls him, but nothing controls him because he can't. Well, a fellow who can't control anything and nothing can control is a fellow who will have to go a long way north before he can have. And the entrance to it is control. This psychiatrist was not himself so thoroughly involved with control. He would really have no trouble with insane people, and he would never have to employ such things as electric shock and other nonsense, which he knows full well makes them away well. If he was capable himself of the level of control of a Scientologist, just running a psycho through action every day or so would straighten the person out. It would be so easy to do. How are you this morning, Mr. Jones? Mr. Jones is gnawing the rug and just his heels are visible from under the bed and squish all over the floor and so forth. How are you this morning, Mr. Jones? That's fine. Now, would you stand up here and let me look at your face, Mr. Jones? Bring him out, standing up, look at Mr. Jones' face, and say, well, thank you, Mr. Jones, and let him go. Come back the next day and do the same thing. After a while, he'd only have to say to Mr. Jones, well, now let's stand up here and take a look at your face. Mr. Jones would promptly. He would obey an order. And at that moment, he could at least have the psychiatrist. Got the idea? Well, now there is the lead out in insane people. You can run communication on them by running mimicry. You can run happiness on them by giving them things. And these have a certain level of workability. But there is nothing that goes as far south as control. But the way we have to do control, size, so unswerving and so positive, that it admits of no argument whatsoever, and you will always stay in high tone control of things. Now, if you only learned how to control people, you would never have any trouble with children or workers or anything else, because most of these people are below the level of happiness. Living below the level of happiness, they are, by older techniques, rather unauditable, but they're certainly not unauditable by control. But unfortunately for you, control is something you have to buck up to, something you have to practice, something you have to understand, to get your willingness to do that completely by 76,000 million trillion jillion years from being convinced that you shouldn't. And it's a very easy thing to do, actually. Now, there's where these things fit, and there's where CCH fits in auditing. And there's where it goes. All of this flashes back simply to isness. Things are what they are. They aren't anything else. If you can just get a preclear and see that directly, you will bypass all of it. But unfortunately, I'm afraid you're never going to do that. But if you get a miracle cure sometime that you just can't quite understand how the man's leg unmoved in front of your eyes, boom, in some way, you've got communication to intertwine with happiness so as to admit of the isness of a leg. And the second that he admitted of the isness of a leg to that degree, his leg got well. Now, there's the route to miracle cures. You don't have to go in that fashion. All you have to do is get him to control his leg